It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear about a new plan to help bees and other pollinators bounce back here in Wisconsin.
First, 2016 is the centennial of the National Park Service. To celebrate, National Geographic Magazine is taking a year-long look at the power of the parks. In their January issue, writer Florence Williams took a look at the science behind the benefits of being in nature.
She joins us now to share what she found out. Florence Williams is a contributing writer for National Geographic Magazine and the author of the article, This Is Your Brain on Nature, from that January issue. Florence, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into the effect that nature has on the brain, I think a big concern these days is, what's the impact of not being out in nature, not having access to green space?
Well, there are some experts who posit that we have a syndrome called nature deficit disorder. So it's a little bit controversial whether that really exists, but some people argue that when we're away from nature, we get more anxious, we might be feeling more depressed, we might be feeling more lonely because we're inside. We have a number of diseases associated with modern life that are also associated with being indoors, a sort of indooritis.
So that's a notion I think a lot of people have had, that it's good to get outside. Parents for years have been fighting that battle with kids, I think. But you write that there's been actual research and experimentation trying to put a number on that, in effect, to try to find some data that shows what happens. What have we learned?
Yeah, that's right. For years, psychologists have been, you know, asking people sort of to fill out questionnaires saying, well, how do you feel when you're outside? How do you feel when you're inside? And they've noticed that people generally report a large boost in mood. They have fewer negative thoughts when they're outside. But it's only been recently, really in the last 5 to 10 years, that scientists have been able to kind of physiologically measure these changes. So they're measuring heart rates, they're measuring blood pressure, they're measuring stress hormones like cortisol. And they're even actually imaging the brain with portable MRI, which is a kind of way to look at the brain, EEG, which looks at brain waves. These are actually things that now we can do in the field. So we're seeing some really new things.
So we're out hiking, and then there's the researcher carrying that MRI along with us on the trail?
That's right. That's right. They're doing that. In fact, I went camping in Utah for the story, and I put on this kind of bathing cap with a number of electrodes, and it measured what different parts of my brain, you know, were doing in terms of brain waves. And the theory of this researcher David Strayer at the University of Utah is that when we're in nature, our frontal lobes, which is the parts of our brain that do a lot of thinking and tasks and checking our to-do box, a lot of that happens in our frontal cortex. He thinks that that frontal cortex kind of takes a little break. It relaxes and kind of turns off, shuts down a little bit. And when that happens, you see some really interesting things going on in your brain. For example, more blood flow to the parts of the brain that are involved with daydreaming or empathy, kindness towards others. And in fact, this holds up in the research. It really looks like when we're outside, we tend to think more about our communities, more about our relationships, and less just about sort of our own negative thoughts.
And that changes our notion of how our brains work from an idea that, hey, they're just our brains, they're always thinking, they have, in effect, infinite capacity until we need to sleep to keep doing stuff. According to this theory, no, the brain needs to step away, shut down a bit, and relax in nature a little bit, it sounds like.
That's right. Your brain is like a muscle in some ways. It needs to rest. And when it doesn't, we get stressed out, we get exhausted. I think we all know that feeling when we're hard at work. We have a million emails coming at us, maybe we're in traffic. You know, we can do these things, and we can do them well for a while, but then what happens is we start getting really tired. We get irritated. We get grumpy. We get stressed out, and we don't even really realize it, or we don't know why.
Talking to Florence Williams from National Geographic about the impact of nature on our brains, mostly good is the short version. But Florence, how much does it take? I mean, is it, you know, a week camping in a national park? Can it be a stroll in a green space? Can it be looking at a spider plant in the office? How much green do we need to make a difference here?
Well, some people are starting to look at nature almost as a medicine. And so when you do that, like a lot of medicines, there's a dose curve. So it looks like the more time in nature, the better. You know, if you can get out for 3 or 4 days of backpacking, it can really do wonders for your sense of self, for your life plans, maybe recovering from grief. You know, there are these sort of profound changes that you can enable by being in the wilderness for many days. But the good news is you can actually get small positive effects from even a five-minute dose of nature. Even looking out your window at a nice view and taking a break from your computer, even a 40-second break can make you temporarily more creative and can boost your mood. And the country of Finland, for example, is now recommending that people get out for at least 5 hours a month into a natural area or a park or a forest. And that's not too bad. You know, that's a little over an hour a week of strolling through the woods. And they think that that's enough to really ward off depression.
And Finland's not alone. You say this idea is becoming public policy in a lot of places, including South Korea has a really interesting, innovative approach to this. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's right. South Korea, like many parts of the world, it has a lot of stressed-out workers, people who work too hard, spend a lot of time in offices, a lot of time in computers. And the government is concerned about this and looking for ways to kind of reduce stress. And so the Forest Service there has initiated this neat program of 37 healing forests. And those encompass trails on mountains and in forests and 500 rangers who specialize in programs to help reduce stress or to help heal people with cancer, to kind of prevent depression in prenatal women. There are even bullying in schools. So there are all these programs that the country is really putting into place, and they're free programs largely for everyone to use.
And maybe virtual nature could help. You wrote about a program at a prison somewhere in the United States, I think, that was trying nature videos for prisoners in solitary confinement. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's true. There's a prison, Snake River Correction Institution, and it's an interesting place where inmates are in solitary confinement. It's a pretty stressful environment. And in one wing of the prison, researchers have put into place these videos of nature in the exercise room. And in another part of the prison, they just have kind of a normal, you know, very bland exercise room. And the reports that we're getting out of there is that it's a lot quieter and calmer, and the inmates just seem sort of less violent, less reactive if they're working out in this room where they're showing beautiful pictures of, you know, there are a number of ones you can choose from. There are sort of underwater videos of fish or their forests, and apparently the inmates just really love being in there.
And this is a noisy place usually, but inmates are saying, hey, quiet down, I'm watching my nature video now.
That's right. And sometimes they're going in there if they're feeling like they need to calm down.
So, Florence, you're a writer for National Geographic. If I may stereotype, I would assume you're someone who likes to get out in nature. But having looked into this issue, having done this research, has this made little nature time more of a priority in your daily life?
You know, it really has. I live in a big city. I live in Washington, D.C. It's not always so easy to get outside into a natural area. It's a, you know, noisy place with lots of asphalt, lots of traffic. But I really do make an effort now. Fortunately, there are a lot of parks here. And, you know, most American cities do have terrific parks. Sometimes it takes a little bit of an effort to get out and use them. But I highly recommend it.
And a timely question, does getting out in a park that's covered in snow have the same impact for you as a park that's looking green?
You know, there has been a little bit of research in this, and even when it's cold and nasty outside, it does seem to be good for our brains to get out, get some fresh air, you know, get away from, you know, our electronic devices and our to-do lists. People who go for walks, even on rainy, windy days, come back, and their productivity and their creativity increase when they get back.
Well, Florence, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thanks so much. I've enjoyed it, Rob.
That's Florence Williams, contributing writer for National Geographic Magazine, author of the piece This Is Your Brain on Nature in their January issue. She joined us to talk about how nature can help our often overstressed brains.
Coming up, a look at a new plan to help beekeepers, land managers, and home gardeners protect pollinators in Wisconsin.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we'll look at the president's new executive actions on solitary confinement in federal prisons.
First, as Wisconsin struggles to come back from a huge die-off of commercial bees in 2014, a new cooperative plan to help pollinators is ready to go. The plan is an effort from the state of Wisconsin with help from the UW and input from beekeepers, environmental groups, and agricultural interests.
Sean Petty is with us now to talk about the new pollinator protection plan. He's the administrator of the Agricultural Resource Management Division of the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, where did the idea for the pollinator protection plan first come from?
About a year and a half ago or so, Secretary Brancel was at a meeting of the National Association of State Departments of Agriculture with other secretaries of agriculture from around the country, and there was a lot of discussion about hive die-offs, reduction in pollinator numbers in general. And there was a very much a level of concern about this. Secretary Brancel came back from that meeting and gave us a charge and wanted us to take a look at what the big picture was of what the issues are, what the impacts on pollinators are, and what people need to know to be able to help the situation. In order to do that, we applied for a USDA specialty crop grant, which we were successful in getting. And cooperatively, as you said, we worked with the UW-Madison Entomology Department, and we started on developing the plan.
And just in general, how are pollinators like bees and butterflies doing in Wisconsin right now?
Well, they're okay. I mean, there have been issues with some die-off, but we have areas where they've come back strong. But I would tell you what the real point that we're trying to do with the plan, it's educational. We want it to be an outreach tool to get out to everybody, not just commercial or hobbyist beekeepers, not just farmers, but homeowners, to give them the tools that they need to know what they can do to help expand and improve pollinator habitat, what they can do to minimize stresses on both wild and commercial hives, and what both hobbyists and commercial beekeepers can do to improve the health of their own hives.
And I want to get to some of those practical suggestions, but first I want to get a little bit of a broader context. Tell us a little bit about why pollinators are important. Why should we care?
Well, about globally, pollinators are responsible, I've got some numbers here, that they're responsible for 35% of all crop production in the world. In Wisconsin alone, they account for over $55 million worth of crops. And that's everything from the apple and cherry orchards to, a lot of people don't realize, that cranberries are pollinated and by bees.
So if we haven't got our pollinators, the agricultural landscape suddenly looks a lot more in jeopardy.
And so does your grocery store.
Your prices at the market.
Exactly. Exactly. So this is a very, very important topic. And as I said, what we really want the plan to be is it's two parts. And we want people to know what the roles of pollinators are as just an educational piece. We want people to understand what the concerns are out there. But at the same time, we want to give them practical points for improving habitat, how we can improve health, and what people can do, not only on a farm, but what we can do as public, for public spaces, what we can do in our yards, that will help pollinators. And I'm not just talking about honeybees.
We're talking right now to John Petty, the administrator of the Agricultural Resource Management Division at the Wisconsin Agricultural Department, talking about the state's new pollinator protection plan. And John, you said we're not just talking about honeybees here. What are we talking about?
We are talking about both commercial hives and wild bees. There are, I want to say something like 400 different types of bees in the state of Wisconsin. And that's just incredible, the variety of plants that these insects work on is just incredible. Everything that flowers, they're on. And when we see a flowering field, that is a buffet table for pollinators.
Well, let's go there. So what should we be planting to make it a yummy buffet for bees?
Well, there's a couple things. There's a couple things that in what we've developed and what we've got out for public comment are what are called best management practices, BMPs. One thing that we can do, at least in the agricultural field, that don't necessarily mow those fields just after you've got your crop up. If there's spaces in between, you don't need to mow that and keep that pristine. Let it flower. Let some wildflowers come up in that. One of the things for a homeowner, don't necessarily feel that you have to have a pristine lawn all the time. If there's a couple dandelions out there, again, that's food for the pollinators. If you have got a green thumb and you want to put in some plants, think of native plants that the pollinators have evolved to feed on, rather than bringing in an exotic that really the pollinators haven't experienced.
Something you say like tulips and some roses are, they don't have a lot of pollen anymore. What are some of these native plants that we should be thinking about planting?
Well, I can tell you the one that I've got in my yard, and I don't know if it's native, but the butterflies and the bees and the bumblebees love it, is lavender.
Mm.
They are all over that. I don't have the list. I'm not a horticulturalist, so I don't have a list in front of me of the plants that we should or that would be attractive to butterflies and to bees. But if it's flowering and you see pollen on it, it doesn't necessarily have to be a cultivated plant, just wildflowers. Look at a wildflower mix. And that's, like I said, that's going to be a buffet table to pollinators.
I want to talk a little bit now about pesticides, because there is some evidence that bee die-off has been linked, it looks like, to pesticide use. What do we need to know about using pesticides? Because your report, it doesn't say don't use pesticides at all. You've got practical guidelines. What do we need to know?
Well, the point about pesticides is just one of the potential factors that puts stress on pollinators. It is not the single sole factor. Part of it, before I get back to pesticides, we can have weather that affects them. There can be literally lack of diet, lack of water resources. In times where there is a drought, remember, they need water too, and that could affect it. There are parasites and viruses that affect bees, both wild and commercial hives. All of these are factors on it. With pesticides specifically, we have regulations on those And specifically, EPA, the federal EPA, has come out with some potential new rules for pesticides that are specific, that would not allow specific pesticide use when there are commercial hives being used in the area. So the general point is follow the label. The label has got restrictions that make it as safe as it can be to use those. If you follow the label, you're pretty much in good stead.
And John, just briefly as we wrap up, now that the pollinator protection plan is out there, what is your greatest hope about how it impacts pollinator habitat and health in Wisconsin?
We don't want to hear stories of people that have got orchards or a cranberry marsh that they have not got access to bees, that they cannot get a hold of commercial hive owners that can come in to pollinate their crops. We want there to be a lot of healthy bees.
John, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was John Petty, Administrator of the Agricultural Resource Management Division of Wisconsin Agriculture Department. A link to the Pollinator Protection Plan is up right now on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up after the news, we'll look at President Obama's new executive actions on solitary confinement in federal prisons. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new bill in the state assembly would grant underage drinking amnesty to young people who are reporting sexual assaults. We'll speak with a co-author of that legislation.
First, President Obama is rolling out new guidelines aimed at restricting the use of solitary confinement in America's federal prisons. In an opinion piece published today in the Washington Post called Why We Must Rethink Solitary Confinement, the president lays out a series of executive actions and calls the excessive use of solitary confinement an affront to our common humanity.
Among those actions is a ban on solitary confinement for juveniles in federal prisons. Other steps are aimed at significantly curtailing the use of solitary confinement and putting limits on how long a first-time offender can spend in one of these units.
Here with us now to talk more about the president's actions is Reverend Willie Briscoe. He's the president of the Wisconsin faith-based group Wisdom, which advocates for criminal justice reform. He's also an associate minister at New Covenant Baptist Church in Milwaukee. Reverend Briscoe, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what do you make of this week's announcement about solitary confinement from the president?
Well, those of us who've been engaged in this work for a period of time somewhat optimistic that this is beginning to gain attention throughout the country, because one of the little hidden secrets is what happens to people when they are enter into the criminal justice system. Is there actual corrections? Are they actually prepared for when they come outside of those institutions back into the public? And we are finding out that solitary confinement is placing another layer of mental illness on people who are already suffering.
In his opinion piece, the president, as we just talked about there, he called unnecessary solitary confinement an affront to our common humanity. That's strong language. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I do, because that is a profession that I worked in. And what has gone unheard and unsaid is that a lot of these individuals who are going into these institutions are already suffering a level of mental illness and some type of disenfranchisement that solitary confinement only exacerbates. What it is the criminal justice system, in order sometimes to save money, has incarcerated individuals who could have been better served by getting some type of mental health assessment and some type of intervention. And when you put those in jail and in prison and put them into another level of prison, disenfranchising them further, it actually harms more than does any good.
And earlier you said it puts another layer of mental illness on some of the issues these inmates are facing. What do we know about what kind of psychological consequences that solitary confinement can have?
Well, there's a prevailing thought in our public views that when we put people in jail, they're going to be punished and they're going to be treated harshly. But one of the things that people forget, to be taken away from society and to be placed in a place where you have very little of any freedoms and you don't have any outside, which might say stimulants, that in itself causes a level of depression. And now, not to give treatment and not to address these issues, you are really turning loose a population that has not only not been served while behind bars, but have basically been made worse.
So you're saying that solitary confinement not only does not serve to correct inmates who undergo it, but is also maybe not fair to the population who's receiving these inmates back into society at the end of their term?
Exactly. Most of the individuals that you'll find acting out in jail are doing it either for a medical, untreated medical, unidentified medical reason, or some form of mental illness. Then you figure out an easier way to deal with this than to get them treated, just to lock them away and put them in an isolation cell for 60 days and sometimes 2 to 3 years. That is a condition that human beings aren't equipped to handle. I often tell individuals that I meet, if you want to see how your mind plays tricks on you, limit yourself to your house for like 3 hours. Place it on your own heart center. You can't go anywhere for 3 hours and see how many places and what your mind does in that little three-hour period. Now, you take that and place it in years and in decades, you can understand what might be faced when you see these individuals who come from out of this solitary confinement.
You're describing a lot of inmates who have a mental illness, and they're being put in solitary confinement instead of being treated. Why are so many people being missed, or why are so many people who need help with mental illness not being given the treatment they need?
Well, and this is I'll speak from experience, and I'll also speak from my own feelings. It has been widely known that the system states that it's easier to place someone in a criminal situation rather than in a treatment situation, because they feel that if you put people in treatment, it costs more and it's more laborious. But when you look at it, if you haven't treated these individuals, you keep putting them into a criminal justice system, you'll find out that in time you'll pay triple what you would normally pay if you treated this person to begin with.
We're talking right now with the Reverend Willie Briscoe of the group Wisdom, talking about the president's new executive actions on solitary confinement. And another change that's being rolled out, the longest a prisoner can be punished with solitary confinement for a first offense will be 60 days rather than the current maximum, which is 365 days. What do you think about that new number?
That new number gives us some hope that this is gaining attention and that people are beginning to look at this and look behind the bars and see how this is being abused and how it's been used as punitive methods rather than gaining someone's compliance. It's easy if you are not feeling that this inmate or whatever is complying with your rules and regulations to just hide them in this system and punish them for this exorbitant amount of time. So what is happening now with the president's proclamation is beginning to draw attention to this, and it's going to make, I believe, that criminal justice system stand up and look at what they're doing and make changes.
Are there times when you would say that solitary confinement is necessary?
There is always a time for a cooling off period when you have someone who is acting out violently and who might not be responding to medication. There is a time when that person needs to be assessed as to what is the proper place for him in population and what the population numbers should be. But there's never really a reason for anyone to do their entire sentence in solitary confinement. There's always a cause and effect to why people are acting out, and it's incumbent upon the criminal justice system to start finding these reasons and these means and treating these people accordingly.
Now, that 60-day number, you said it's an indication that there's new attention being paid to the issue of solitary confinement, but would you like to see that number reduced, maybe even go away, or do you think that that is a reasonable number, 60 days?
I don't agree that it's a reasonable number, and these have to be taken case by case, but there is always a reason for someone's behavior. And I do think that that as they start whittling down these days, they'll start finding out ways to find, whether they find treatment or find causes for this activity, and to be able to actually place people in numbers. Sometimes people might not work well in larger groups. They might work well in a smaller area with more limited individuals. But I don't think there's ever a positive when someone is put away and have no one else to communicate with but themselves.
Let's zero in on Wisconsin a bit. Can you give us a sense of how solitary confinement is being used, what amount here in Wisconsin?
Well, this is where we actually began our work, because we've talked and worked with several groups and parents who have individuals who have been severely, punished by placing them in solitary confinement without medication or without any real reasons other than why they were acting out. And it's been very difficult for us to get those numbers from the state, and it's been very difficult for us to get a set down and talk with the state officials about how they are using solitary confinement and what would be some alternatives. All we know now is that it's getting attention, and they are behind the scenes beginning to make some adjustments, but not fast enough.
We're talking now with Reverend Willie Briscoe of the group Wisdom, talking about the president's new executive actions on solitary confinement. And you can join in at 800-642-1234.
What do you think about the president's move to limit the use of solitary confinement in federal prisons? Would you like to see a change here in Wisconsin as well? Is this a practice you think should be banned outright, or do you think there are times it's necessary? Have you had experience with this on either side, in a prison, in the state, in a federal prison? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrat. We're talking with Reverend Willie Briscoe from the group Wisdom. They're a state organization advocacy group, talking about President Obama's recent actions restricting the use of solitary confinement in federal prisons. And we'd like to hear from you, too.
What do you make of the president's executive actions, including a ban on solitary confinement for juveniles? Is solitary confinement a practice you'd like to see banned outright, or do you think there are times when it's necessary? And do you think there are better alternatives? And if so, what are they? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we go now to our callers and talk to Elizabeth in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi. I have a pretty well managed mental health problem and bipolar too. And since I've been just one time in an isolation while they were doing evaluation, I can tell you that is just about the worst possible place that you could put somebody who's having the kind of stress you would be having going into prison. And I would love to see them get rid of juvenile solitary. Completely. I mean, I just cannot imagine. Here's a child who, for some reason, has got problems already that are making them act out. And the question ought to be not how can I punish this kid. It should be how do I love this kid until they are healthy again. And locking them up in isolation is—it's just going to break their spirit. I just can't imagine. You know how horrible that is. People use that for torture. You know, in Guantanamo Bay, they do that. So why? Why would we do that with children especially, but for anybody?
Elizabeth, thank you so much for that call. And Reverend Briscoe, your group Wisdom has equated solitary confinement with torture. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, I can. And what it is it's been used as a method of control and a method of punishment rather than compliance. And what that means is that if someone wants to try to get back at a inmate for behavior they consider to be detrimental, they will actually use this as a punishment rather than a means to gain compliance. And what that does is put people at risk and put them in places for periods of time that become detrimental to their health.
Now, these changes from the president, these executive actions, are at the federal level. He says he hopes they serve as a model for states to rethink their rules on this issue. What do you hope Wisconsin comes away with?
Well, I am hoping, since it comes from the president, and this is federal, and it has to do with juveniles, we're hoping that it causes law enforcement entities all around the country to take a serious look at something that's now beginning to gain attention. In the past, it's been what happens behind bars stays behind bars, but we're beginning to see now, because of recidivism and because continued activity that happens outside of the institutions, we're beginning to see that they're causing more harm than good.
Thanks for the call, Elizabeth. Next, we're going to go to Amy. She joins us from Lake Geneva. Amy, hi.
Hi. I had a comment that I really strongly agree with this reverend, his view. I think that even the initial offense should probably be something more like 10 to 30 days of confinement, solitary confinement.
Mm-hmm.
And I also have a comment that I have a firsthand experience also with, not firsthand, but my mother, who has bipolar. We had relocated to a new area, and she had found herself at a hospital exhibiting symptoms of mental illness, and the police ended up, I guess inappropriately placing her in a jail for 3 days, which was the first time that had ever happened to her. And she had lived with this illness for many, many years, and we had just relocated to Wisconsin when this happened. And unfortunately, she was left there without medication or anything for, I believe, 3 days before she was sent to a more appropriate facility. So I can see how, police, I believe, there needs to be more mandatory training for police in dealing with mental illness. That's another issue, possibly. But I did sit on a panel in Walworth County for training of police officers in dealing with mental illness, but I became aware at that training that it was an optional training, and it shouldn't be optional. It should be mandatory.
Amy, thank you so much for your thoughts on that and for sharing your story, your family story, with something similar here. And Reverend Briscoe, do you think that any reform of the criminal justice system has to include a new tack on treating mental illness and also training maybe for law enforcement?
Yes, absolutely, because most of what you would find your necessary confinement would be when there is a violent fight between inmates or whatever. You might want to put them away for a period of 24 hours, 48 hours for a cooling off period. You might want to separate the combatants. But when you place people in these situations for acting out, and when officers can't recognize that the difference between a mental situation and a behavioral situation, it becomes very, very punitive. If you have someone who has a bipolar incident and not violent, to be put away, which makes that incident worse.
The president said in his opinion piece, he said, in America, we believe in redemption. What do you think about that prospect of redemption? Do you think that is something that is agreed upon when we look at criminal justice in the United States? And is it something that we need to think about more as a concept as we look at reform?
Well, we do have to look at redemption, because historically, we have been wanting our pound of flesh from those who have committed crimes. Put them in prison, treat them as harshly as possible, do not give them any means to think that they belong to society again, and make sure that they pay their debt. But what we have forgotten is the putting them in jail, the isolation from family and society, is a huge debt. And if they're going to be coming back to society and coming back among people to live and have prosperous life, we should be investing in everything we can to make them whole again, to make them, not to treat them harshly, because most of them committed crimes and acted out because they felt that they weren't a part of society, that there was something that was lacking. So if you put them in a situation and treat them worse, I don't see how you can expect to turn them back out to society and hope for them to recover.
And we leave it there. Reverend Briscoe, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, and I look forward to working with you in the future.
That was Reverend Willie Briscoe, president of the state faith-based group Wisdom, which advocates for criminal justice reform. He's also an associate minister at New Covenant Baptist Church in Milwaukee. He joined us to talk about the president's executive actions on the use of solitary confinement in federal prisons.